Let's talk about libraries today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Rock Island's Public Library Director Angela Campbell is our guest today, and so is Garrison Keeler with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Angela, thank you very much. I know you're busy. All libraries are busy, but it's good to have a chance to talk to you and talk a little bit about libraries in general. But first of all, I'm wondering how you got into this business. What led you to library science?
Oh, it started a long time ago. Well, actually, my mom always brought me to the library, so it was a place I was very familiar with. And then a second cousin of mine was actually a librarian, and she kind of got me interested in the field. And so my first job in high school was at the Scott County Library as a library page. And at that time, I wasn't so thrilled with it. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was 15. so as I went on to college and started working in libraries even more, I decided this is definitely what I want to do. And so I went on to graduate school, and that's my story, and I haven't looked back. I love public librarianship, especially because of what we stand for and what we mean to communities.
What has your profession been since college? Where have you worked?
Well, right out of graduate school, I was at the Davenport Public Library. And for 7 years, I was reference and book discussion group coordinator. And then they created a new department because they were opening their two new branches, the public relations and programming coordinator. And I got to develop a brand new department and design all the programs and help with promoting those programs. And so after that, I really wanted to become a library director. And I knew that in the library world, you have to start at a smaller library, and a job came open in Western Iowa in Glenwood. Glenwood Public Library is about 10 miles south of Council Bluffs area, and
That's a way west.
It was west, and I had never been that way, and I just wanted a new experience, and so I went out there, and I was only there for 2 years, and I had a great time. We did a $175,000 renovation of the Children's and Youth Services Department, but then the Rock Island job opened, and at that time, my parents were still back in the Quad Cities area, and I needed to come home for reasons because of them. And, you know, I always knew about Rock Island. I had, you know, grown up using that library as well as the other libraries in the Quad Cities. And so I thought I would try for it, and they liked me and hired me. And I've been there for 4 years and 7 months now.
My goodness. are you a library user?
Minored in library science in college because I was going to be a librarian. And then I got to graduate school and used the rare book room and spent a summer out at the Beinecke Library in Yale going over manuscripts of Jonathan Edwards. And then I really wanted to be a rare books librarian and look for watermarks and look for kind of, was this paper before 1640 or after 1640? I thought that would, but I got hooked on libraries, I think, like Angela did. My mother, I can remember my mother taking me for the first time. I was probably six, down to the Jackson Public Library, which is in the basement of the courthouse, dark and dingy, with one of those librarians that, you know, I think her only vocabulary was shh. And there I was allowed to take out two books a week. I read every book there was on ants and bees. I don't know what I got interested in, but I just loved being there. It was for me. This isn't an exaggeration, a sacred space.
Oh,
and it wasn't the books, just it was the building, right?
The most mystical experience I had as a kid was to go back in the stacks in the main library in Memphis. Oh, that was something.
Oh, I would spend several, when I went to the University of Chicago for grad school, and that library went down 6 floors underneath the ground. And I'd go down to the floor 5, which contained, 17th century newspapers, and just spend the day down there, dark, with nobody else even near the. And so I got to thinking, knowing that Angela was going to be here today, that in the same way that in the Quad Cities, you have a lot of people who live along the river, but you also have river rats for whom this is a sacred place, the river. And that's true of libraries, too, I think. What is it about library buildings that make them almost church-like?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think it's a feeling of when you walk in.
But you must have patrons who come in. Well, I know you do, right?
Sure.
Because you talk about moving the 3031 bridge. You can't do that. That's my space, right? And it really is.
Most people equate very positive things from their childhood, even up through adulthood, with going to the library. And because it's normally in a building, or at least it has been in many years, for many years, they think of that as their space.
Right. And I mean, they really take it personally, I think.
Well,
do.
There's something about it, though. I remember the first time they let me in the adult section of the downtown library. And that meant you could walk back in the stacks. And walking in those stacks with the opaque glass floors was as mystic and mysterious an experience as I'd ever had. And around me were all these books. To me, the library has always been the answer to every question I ever had. Mm-hmm. And suddenly to be in the middle of it all and have access to all this stuff, all these people, all these thoughts, was just overwhelming. I couldn't believe it. How they let me in. Did they know what they were doing? I'd take out as many books as they'd let me take out. It was just amazing. Yeah, the library is a sacred space. Yes. But that does give you problems when you talk about changing from one location to another. Mm-hmm. How is that proceeding, or is it proceeding?
We're still working on our fundraising study. I mean, it takes a lot of people to make a new building or a renovations or anything like that to happen because, we have city support. We have support from our library district, which is in Milan Blackhawk Library District. But we also receive a lot of support from people who use us. They either purchase old books through our book sales, or they just give us general donations, and our foundation as well. They accept those and then grant that money to the library to use for specific projects. So because of how long it can take to fundraise and not everybody is going to donate to things that they're not interested in, or if they aren't necessarily happy with the choice, they might choose not to, unfortunately. But we feel that we have chosen the best option for Rock Island, who is used to having 3 libraries in their city. That's the hard part. We're not a huge city, but we've had that luxury, if you will, for our patrons to use the 3 different locations. And they are different from one another, and their purposes are different from one another right now.
Well, the feel is different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, where are we in this? Has anything been settled on, or are you still considering options?
No, we're moving forward with the option of renovating the downtown library to be a space, as well as we hope to purchase the Tri-City Jewish Center and make that the central library, and then keep our Southwest library where it's at out in Southwest Rock Island. That's what we're moving towards. We're just trying to secure financing for that option.
The Jewish Center would make a superb central library.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that quite frankly, that building was overbuilt from the beginning, and it cries out for some kind of big public use.
Mm-hmm.
But acquiring that and equipping it is not going to be easy.
No, it's not. And I think that's where we're at right now, is trying to figure out how are we going to afford it and do the option that we've chosen, and to make it, you know, a neighborhood library with modern amenities, as well as the downtown library being a neighborhood library with modern amenities. We don't want to necessarily duplicate our efforts at both places. Downtown is definitely a local history spot, you know, a genealogy spot and reference, whereas a neighborhood library is more like what you get from our current branches,
mm-hmm.
popular reading materials. And
it
programs.
Would seem to me that you have another difficulty in this day of Kindles and Nooks and internet and downloading stuff. There's an argument, you know, that you don't need books, that we can put everything on computer. And of course, once a solar flare takes all of that stuff out, what are you left
right.
with?
Well, I've, you know, definitely heard that argument, but print circulation and use has not decreased. In fact, if you add our print circulation, meaning your traditional books, to electronic use, we actually have more use now than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know all my kids use Kindle. I have to hold a book mm-hmm. in my hand and open the pages and see.
That's
the
because
print.
You're hopelessly old.
I'm hopelessly old, but
and so am I.
But I'm not sure. You know how something is transmitted really makes a difference, and where it's transmitted. You know, studying in a library that's old and has Gothic windows and stuff versus something that's modern and all glass, it makes a difference where you read a piece of information and how that piece of information comes to you.
But the whole business of reading forms the mind in a particular way. And if you've been raised on computers and phone books and so on, then iPhones, I should say, your mind is being shaped a different way. It really is. It's there's something about reading. As you read, the mind forms images and associations and so on in a different way. And a psychologist will tell you this. So we are entering an age where people's minds are shaped differently. And I worry about that.
Well, I mean, that must give you some cause for concern. How many magazines do you subscribe to, since every article and every one's available online, right?
Well, not everything. A lot of things are for a fee online. And, you know, we provide those things for free through your tax
right.
dollars. So we have magazines that we subscribe to that our cardholders can check out online.
Right.
So we're paying for it. But to always be able to read the full content of a magazine, no, you can't do that for free unless you have a subscription. I think it's just how the information, like you say, is presented. You can either read it in digital form or in print form. And some things are now only available in the digital form. So if you want to read it at all, you have to be comfortable using an iPhone or an iPad to do so.
How do you decide what books to order? Since last year in the United States, I read there were 300,000 new books published, in addition to the 700,000 self-published.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. How many do you order a year out of that 300,000?
I don't know if that's just fiction or nonfiction, both.
That's
but
everything.
I think we add about, I want to say about 15,000 items a year.
15,000?
Mm-hmm.
A year?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the books that are crowded out?
We look for condition, and we have to cull, weed them, and we either sell them at the book sale. We put them in the little free libraries where people can take the books. Sometimes we just have to throw them away. Because
how long do you keep a book typically? Let's say a standard mystery.
Mm-hmm. It depends on the condition, and if it's in bad condition, that's a no-brainer. We just have to throw it away. If it's still popular, meaning it's checking out quite
right.
a few times, and it's still in print, we usually do reorder it. We run reports through our circulation system to see how popular they are, with popular materials especially, because there isn't enough shelf space.
That bothers me now because I remember going to a library and looking for a particular book and opening it, and no one had checked it out for 20 years, but it was still there. And I thought, thank heavens, because I'd be in trouble without this book. But no one else had checked it out for 20 years. Then I think of what you do when you go to a grocery store and you use the little cards for discounts and so on. A computer decides which products are selling and which ones aren't. The ones that aren't selling, we get rid of. The ones that are selling, we keep.
Or what level to put them on in the grocery store, way at the bottom or the eye level? Or...
Yeah,
and the thing is, you know, can you really apply that kind of a standard to a book?
Oh, no. I mean, that's one part of collection development, is looking at the circulation history. A human actually goes and touches it and looks at it and makes that decision. And if it is a book that has some sort of historic value, or we think people will need to use it for research, because just because it doesn't check out doesn't mean they didn't use it in the library. And so there's a lot of decision making that does go on when deciding whether or not to remove a book.
So Plato's Republic is always going to be there.
As long as there's room for it. But the other option is, you know, because the collection keeps growing and we don't have enough space for everything, you know, we work really hard to work with other libraries, so you can get it on interlibrary loan and through the local delivery system. So even if we don't have it, we know we can get a copy for someone within a day or two.
How do you work that out? Do libraries let one another know we're letting go of this, or you keeping a copy? Is it all accident or is it purposeful?
That's part of the collection development. Because we're in Prairie Cat, which has, I don't remember how many millions of items, we can look it up and see how many other libraries have it. If a substantial amount of other libraries have it, that means we can get it, like I say, within a day or two for somebody. If we truly just don't have enough room for it and it's not popular, say, for our population, because collection development also goes into what your public wants to read. Public librarianship is totally different than like academic, where you do usually keep copies of as much as you can that, you know, is historical.
Are there private libraries you can access?
Like from far away.
Yeah.
Usually we can call if there's something that somebody needs, and they might not send a rare book, but they can send us information from it. So it really would depend what the question is.
So the state of the library is in some transition right now, huh?
It is.
Okay.
It's really exciting, because it really makes us look at what do we want to be in the future. I mean, I started 20 years ago, and at that time our library was launching their first website. Well, now you carry around a phone has more information than you. I mean, I couldn't have predicted that. So what we can do moving forward is try to be as more as module as we can with furniture, with and being just adaptive, knowing that we're going to have to be, because we don't know what the next new thing is going to be.
We haven't even talked about all the other things the library does for activities for kids, for adults, for teenagers.
And we're not going to be able to spend time. But it's true. There's so much activity going on at the library. You put out a schedule. Mm-hmm. I know I see it, and I think, holy mackerel, who has time to read?
Right.
Angela Campbell, director of the Rock Island Public Library, thank you very much for visiting us today. And with that, we'll go visit our friend Garrison Keeler. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. In the book bag today, I'd like to start with a book by John le Carré. Recently, a biography of John le Carré came out, and he does not like people talking about his life. He decided to put out a book that really is just a series of articles, references about people he's met, and he seems to have met everybody in the world. It's called The Pigeon Tunnel, Stories from My Life. And in the middle of the book, there's a chapter called The Biggest Bears in the Garden, where he has dinner with heads of Soviet secret police and so on. And one of them is a fellow named Primakov, Evgeny Primakov, and he invites David and his wife to dinner. at some point, they get to talking about Saddam Hussein, Bush, Margaret Thatcher, and the Gulf War. And then he says, when you're caught in a vodka marathon, an English friend urged me for the first time to stick to vodka, don't go for the lethal Crimean champagne. And then Primakov says, you know Desert Storm, David? Yes, Evgeny, I know Desert Storm. Saddam, he was a friend for me. You know what I mean by friend, David? Yes, Evgeny, I think in this context I know what you mean by friend. Saddam, he telephones to me, indignation mounting. Evgeny, save my face. Get me out of Kuwait. He allows time for the significance of this request to sink in. Gradually it does. He is telling me that Saddam Hussein asked him to persuade George Bush Sr. to let him pull his forces out of Kuwait with dignity, save his face, in which case there need be no war between the United States and Iraq. So I go to Bush, he continues, striking angrily at the name. This man is, tense discussion with the interpreter. If it is on the tip of Primakov's tongue to use strong language to describe George Bush Sr., he restrains himself. This Bush is not cooperative, he asserts reluctantly, and allows himself a grimace of indignation. Therefore I come to England, he resumes, to Britain, to your Thatcher I come. Another flurried consultation with his interpreter, and this time I catch the Russian word dacha, which is about the only one I know. Checkers, says the interpreter. So, I come to checkers. A hand flies up commanding our silence, but the entire table is dead silent already. For 1 hour, this woman lectures me. They want the war. That is a stunner.
Whoa.
That Saddam wanted to get out of having a
right.
war, and neither Bush nor Thatcher wanted that. That's a little bombshell right in the middle
wow.
of this book of
recollections. What's the name of the book again?
It's called The Pigeon Tunnel, Stories from My Life. The final story is the story of his relationship with his father, who was a con artist and was in jail and out of jail. And his life with his father was not happy. His father was very wealthy or very poor, but you couldn't trust anything he said. And some people said it's small wonder that he wound up, his name is David Cornwall, but he wound up in Secret Service and then later on writes so vividly of the Secret Service. Also early in the book, he talks about the people in the spy community did not like him because he had written about things. He's careful not to reveal any secrets, but he does not write flatteringly. He doesn't write propaganda for the clandestine service. He depicts them as being as flawed as everybody else. But I thought this book would be a bit of fluff, but it's just fascinating from one end to the other. John Le Carré's The Pigeon Tunnel, Stories from My Life, and they are sensational. So that'll do it for now. I've used up all the book bag space, but you have it next week.
Oh, I will take it next week.
Okay, and we'll see you next week for the next Scribble.